All of us have probably looked through a Where's Waldo book before, right? You know, the one where you're looking for Waldo, the guy wearing the red and white striped shirt. This series actually kind of started by accident. The illustrator just wanted to practice drawing crowds, and soon people were really excited, children especially, to find Waldo in the book. Now, as this thing has progressed, you're actually looking for more than just Waldo. My kids and I did this last summer, where we were looking through, and there's a bunch of things and people you're supposed to find. So there we are looking for the key and the binoculars and the dog bone and Wanda and Waldo and the wizard and a few other people as well that you're all trying to find. Now, as you look through the book, the first page is relatively easy, right? You can find Waldo pretty quickly on the page. You can find all the other things because there's not as many people there. The setting isn't too complex, but as you get through the book, it becomes more and more challenging to actually find Waldo on the page. And by the end of the book, you're looking for him amongst a sea of people also wearing red and white clothing. And you might see just his face or a little bit of his body. You don't actually see all of him. It's pretty hard to find him by the time you get to the end of the book. And so you have to persevere. Your eyes get tired, and yet you keep scanning the page over and over again until finally you see, oh yeah, there he is. He was on the page after all. Well, sometimes that's a little bit what life with God feels like, right? Where you're trying to find where God is at work. And on some days, it's really easy to see. Everything is turning up really, really well. You've got circumstances that are reminding you of God. You look at the creation or the night sky and you think, wow, isn't God amazing? He feels like he's really close to you. You're getting encouragement from people. You open the Word of God and it felt like God was speaking directly to you, and just amazing, God is everywhere. But then there are other times, you know this, where it's really, really hard to see where is God in all of this. How do I see where God is at work here? It feels like circumstances and just life events are working against me, and I feel like I'm all alone. God, why do you feel so distant? And I can't see you in how you're working. Sometimes it feels like we're near the end of the book of Where's Waldo, and God is impossible to find. Well, the story of Ruth demonstrates for us God's provision for his people in circumstances that seemed pretty desperate. In fact, as we looked at chapter 1 last week, we saw that there was really desperate circumstances for Naomi and for her daughters-in-law. Naomi moved from Israel to Moab because of a famine, and while she was there, her husband and her two sons died, leaving her with two daughters-in-law. And she decided, I'm going to go back to Israel because I hear there's food there and I'm going to return to my people. She said, daughters-in-law, you guys should stay here with your own families. And one of them stayed, Orpah stayed, but Ruth said, no, I'm coming with you. And so they travel to Israel, but it's kind of a hopeless situation. You know, Naomi says to the people, my name Naomi means pleasant, but call me Mara, which means bitter. This isn't a pleasant circumstance. And actually she says, Yahweh, God has done this to me. He sent me away full and I've returned empty. Have you ever blamed God for something? This is what Naomi's doing. She's saying, where is God? I can't find him anywhere. And yet as the story develops, and as we'll see in chapter 2, we start to see hints that no, God's actually working in this. And God's actually been working in this all along. And he's providing for them. We're calling this series Extraordinary Faithfulness, extra in brackets, because we actually see this faithfulness in a couple of different ways. We see God's extraordinary faithfulness. We saw this already last week, and we'll see it again, where the text talks about God's chesed. This is God's faithfulness, his loving kindness, his patience, his mercy, his goodness, his grace. It's all of these attributes of God wrapped up in this one mega word in Hebrew, chesed. We see God's extraordinary faithfulness, even when it seems like all is lost. God is still working. He's still providing. He's still being good to his people. But it's also a story of ordinary faithfulness. Many of the stories that we read, or many of the stories that are preserved from antiquity, are stories of people of great renown, people who are warriors or kings or important people. And yet here we have a story of two widows who are traveling back to their homeland and trying to find a way for themselves. They're not notable people in any other way. And yet here we find their story, which is really quite ordinary. And the way that the book is written highlights some of the ways in which this is just ordinary life that's happening. And yet God is present in that ordinary life. And so the challenge for those of us who are living ordinary lives is to be faithful in the ordinary. You know, God's faithfulness is extraordinary. Ours often feels very ordinary, and yet it's what we're invited to. And as we submit to that, God actually does something with it and uses it in a powerful way. So we move into Act 2 of this four-act story. Our big idea today is this: God's gracious provision comes to us through various means. God's gracious provision comes to us through various means. And we're going to see five ways in which God actually provides for Ruth and for Naomi and even for us. And they are these: God's grace comes to us through circumstances, through other people, through our own effort, through His law, and through His provision in the big picture. So we'll look at those as we go through. But first, I'm going to read Ruth chapter 2. Like last week, we're not going to put the words on the screen. We invite you just to listen along. Maybe close your eyes and picture this story as it develops. This is how the first hearers of this story, and for centuries, people would have just heard it in this kind of a way. And so I'll read it from scholar and Hebrew expert Daniel Block's translation of the book of Ruth. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a rich nobleman from the clan of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabite woman, said to Naomi, "I would like to go to the field and glean the ears of grain behind someone who will be gracious to me." And so she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she went, and she entered a field, and she gleaned in the field behind the harvesters. By sheer luck, she came upon the field allotment belonging to Boaz, who is from the clan of Elimelech. And look, Boaz happened to come from Bethlehem. And he said to the harvesters, "May Yahweh be with you." And they said to him, "May Yahweh bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who supervised the harvesters, "To whom does this young woman belong?" And the young man who supervised the harvesters answered, "She is a young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the fields of Moab. And she said, 'I would like to glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' Now she has come, and she has stood from then in the morning until now. This, her sitting the house a little." Now that's a really choppy sentence, so let's interrupt the narrative here. The Hebrew is really confusing here. Basically, the supervisor is saying to Boaz, "This woman has come and worked really hard, and she's just taking a little break right now." And Boaz said to Ruth, "Have you not heard, my daughter? Do not go to glean in another field, and do not leave this place at all. But thus you shall do: stick to my servant girls, keep your eyes on the field where they're harvesting, and follow them. I hereby charge the young man not to harass you. When you are thirsty, you may go to the water jars and drink from whatever the young men draw." Then she fell down on her face and bowed to the ground, and she said to him, "Why have you been gracious to me that you should notice me, especially since I'm a foreigner?" And Boaz answered, and he said to her, "Everything has been fully reported to me: how you treated your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, and how you abandoned your father and mother and your native land, and how you went to a people that you did not previously know. May Yahweh reward you for your actions, and may your compensation be full from Yahweh, the God of Israel, to whom you've come to seek refuge under His wings." And she said, "You're gracious to me, my lord, that you have comforted me, and that you've spoken tenderly to your maidservant, even though I'm not ranked with your maidservants." And at mealtime, this is a little bit later now, Boaz said to her, "Come over here and eat from the bread, and dip your piece into the sauce." Then she sat down beside the harvesters, and he passed her the roasted grain. So she ate and was satisfied, and she had some food left over. When she got up to glean, Boaz charged his young men, saying, "Even among the sheaves let her glean, and do not insult her. Furthermore, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them so that she may glean, and do not harass her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it amounted to approximately an ephah of barley. That's 30 to 50 pounds of barley. She picked it up and went into the town. She showed her mother-in-law what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave what she had left over from the meal after she was satisfied. Then her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where did you work? May the one who noticed you be blessed." And she explained to her mother-in-law with whom she had worked. And she said, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by Yahweh, because he has not abandoned his loving kindness towards the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is our close relative. He is one of our redeemer kinsmen." Then Ruth the Moabite said, "This is what he said to me, 'Stick close to the servants who brought me, who belong to me, until they have finished harvesting the entire crop that belongs to me.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with a servant girl so that no one will molest you in some other field." So she stuck with Boaz's servant girls, gleaning until the barley harvest and wheat harvest were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law. So you can see the story takes a turn here towards something more positive. You can see that God is working and has been working behind the scenes, and God's gracious provision is starting to become evident to Ruth. And so there's five ways, as I mentioned, that I think this story shows us that God's gracious provision comes to us. The first one is our circumstances, that God orchestrates things in such a way that his grace is provided to us. Remember the context of the book of Ruth. Ruth is sandwiched in the Protestant Bible between the book of Judges and the book of 1 Samuel. The book of Judges tells us about the spiritual degeneracy of the people. They were in this cycle of apostasy, of sin, and they got to this low point as a result of their sin, and they cried out to the Lord, and God provided for them a judge who saved them temporarily from the situation they were in, but then they just kept repeating this pattern over and over again. And the book ends on a really helpless note. This is a spiritually dry place. Now, the book of 1 Samuel opens this way in chapter 3, verse 1. It says this, "In those days, the word of the Lord was rare. There was not many visions." Okay, you get a picture of the spiritual landscape that's happening here. It's not a godly place to be. And yet this is where Ruth finds herself. Now, when she sets out to find a field, we don't really know how she did that or how many fields she went past, or did she look into certain fields and say, that doesn't really look great, or oh, that one doesn't look great. It seems like there was a circumstance in which it was very possible that she would find herself in the field of a cruel man or cruel workers who would actually harass her, maybe even sexually abuse her. And so it happens that she finds herself in the field of Boaz. What drew her to that field? We don't really know, but the author of this book, the narrator, tells us this in a really interesting way. In verse 3, it says in Block's translation, "By sheer luck, she came into this field." The NIV translates this a little bit differently. It says this, "As it turned out, she found herself in Boaz's field." The literal translation of the Hebrew is this: her chance chanced upon the field of Boaz. It's really highlighting this element of chance. Like we might say, she randomly found herself in Boaz's field. Now, that can make us a little bit uncomfortable when we think about the sovereignty of God. Like, what do you mean she just chanced upon it? It was just sheer luck. Really? Like, that's why the narrator is telling us like that. He wants us to ask ourselves, really? Was it really by random chance that Ruth found herself here? Or was it the hidden hand of God that directed her there? Well, that's, of course, where we're being led, that God was leading her there, even though it seemed like it was just a random chance. Right? And so sometimes this is how God provides for us in our lives, as he works out situations and circumstances that may not seem to us at the time to be God's doing, but sometimes in hindsight, we look back and say, oh yeah, okay, I see how God brought all that together. I see how God was working in those circumstances. Meister Eckhart is a German mystic and theologian from the 13th century. He said this, "God is like a person who clears his throat while hiding and so gives himself away." I love that picture. He's like a person that clears his throat while hiding and so gives himself away. He's there. He's on the page. But will you see him? Frederick Buchner was an American preacher and theologian in the last century. He said, "There is no event so commonplace but that God is present within it, always hiddenly, always leaving you room to recognize him or not, because in the last analysis, all moments are key moments, and life itself is grace." So how does God's provision come to us? How does God's grace demonstrate it to us? Well, often it's through the circumstances that he orchestrates around us. You know, we read this in Romans 8:28, and we often take this verse way out of context and probably assign to it meaning that it doesn't actually mean. But Paul says this: "We know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose." So we often read that and say that means that God's going to make our lives smooth and easy. Well, that's not really what it means at all. But it does mean that God is working for the good of those who love him. He's active. His grace is being demonstrated as he orchestrates different situations. And sometimes those situations are painful. And we don't even know necessarily if God orchestrates all of those bad scenarios, right? If evil itself is caused by God, that's problematic, right? But God is the master of turning something that seems evil into something that's good. So with an illustration of this, here's Gabe. You know Gabe. He's the one who introduces these services every week. But he's got a story to share about how he's experienced this in his life recently.
"Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth." That verse has always been a little difficult for me to grasp, because I love to know things. I love to know that God is God, that he is there for us, but I struggle a little bit with the "be still." If you've known me at all, you might know that I like to set myself up to be really busy for certain time periods. I put a lot of things together at once, and I think, oh, if I can just live these kind of 3 or 4 human lives at once between my full-time schooling and my full-time work and a program that I founded at UFV for students, all kinds of different things that go on day by day, week by week, and I just think, if I can just stay on top of it, if I can just get everything submitted, I can go to bed, wake up the next day, and do it all over again. And sometimes in my life that has yielded some great results, and I've had a lot of cause to be grateful to the Lord for sustaining me and giving me energy, and had a lot of cause for pride that these things that I've poured my life into have really worked well all together, all at once. However, sometimes it's a little too much. And sometimes I think I ignore the call to be still for a little too long. This past semester was a difficult one. I was really busy running the UFE esports program that I've started on top of full-time work, and for a time period, full-time school really fell behind, and all of a sudden I found myself struggling to get assignments and struggling to pass courses, and that was really painful for me as someone who takes a lot of pride in my academics over the years. Felt like a cause for shame to be, you know, a former MEI valedictorian now wondering if he can pass his, you know, third year journalism course at the University of the Fraser Valley. But while all of that was starting to crumble and everything was too busy and too much and I kind of could tell I couldn't breathe, I started to see signs that I needed to stop even on top of that. I got really sick multiple times over the course of a few months, which isn't something I usually experience a lot of, and there were a lot of different markers and relationships in my life that I just knew I needed to slow down, but I felt like I could do that once my semester was done, once the UFE esports season was over, once my goals were achieved, then I could stop. And I kept thinking to myself, I just need to trust the Lord that he will be faithful and he will provide me the energy to get me through this. But I think the Lord had other plans about how to provide. You see, God knew that I needed to slow down even when I wouldn't listen to him. And so, a couple of months ago, I was driving down the road in what was, at the time, my car, an 01 Mustang, little blue car I was, you know, vaguely proud of, fun car to drive around. And like you do, I was coming to a stop sign and thinking, I should hit the brakes, I should stop, because that's what the sign says. And I put my foot down on the brake, didn't really slow down. I thought, that's odd. I put it down a little further, the brake hit the floorboard and the car just wouldn't stop. And, you know, I can see now where there's a bit of an overt sermon analogy that maybe I, like the car, had been requested to stop over and over. You know, God's brake was on the floorboard in my life telling me to slow down and I just wouldn't. And so there I am in the car, and it's sort of sliding into an intersection with a lot of cross traffic, and I know I can't let it hit this intersection. I don't want to be chopped in half. And so I took the car, what seemed like the next best option, off the road and hit the stop sign. Kind of used that to stop the car. And I realized, after a little while of thinking through different options, that my life would become a bit like that, where I feel like God had to run me off the road to forcibly stop me because he knew that I wasn't listening to all the signs. And so that was a learning experience for me, something where I had to kind of come to terms with the fact that sometimes God is faithful by allowing difficulties in your life to show you that it is time to be still, to listen to his word. And so as time has gone on, that's become an important lesson for me, and it's something that I'm really grateful for now. But it was a learning experience too, that sometimes God's faithfulness doesn't feel like a great fun day.
Thanks to Gabe. Now, we don't know if God was the one who caused Gabe's brakes to fail, of course, but we know that God is working, even through a situation like that, to speak to Gabe and to teach him something, because God is so good and gracious in that way, that everything that we go through can be a way that God is teaching us. But will we look for it? So God's grace comes to us through circumstances. Secondly, God's grace comes to us through other people. And I put in brackets here, and you yourself, actually. You are used by God to demonstrate his gracious provision to someone else. But God does this through other people. So we meet Boaz early in this chapter. He's actually a relative of Naomi. And we're introduced to him as a noble man. He's a man of standing in the community. People know him. People know his character. People see him as someone that has high character, is generous. We're actually led to believe here in this story that Ruth is treated in this kind of generous way. But even if it was somebody else, probably they also would have been treated in this generous way, because that's just the kind of guy that Boaz is. Now, he also learns about Ruth's circumstances, so he's impressed with her. Some scholars see a romantic connection developing already in chapter 2. Some scholars say, no, that's actually not present here at all, and Ruth herself would never have thought that this maybe would be a possibility, that Boaz would marry her one day. But regardless of what exactly is happening in that way, Boaz takes this interest, and he's super, super kind to her. He models chesed, this kind of loving kindness, mercy, and generosity that we know comes from God. It's actually modeled through Boaz. He's the one who shows Ruth this kind of thing. Now, we see his character even in how he treats his employees. If you're an employer or you have people underneath your authority, take note of Boaz. He greets them in the name of the Lord. They bless him back. There's obviously a good relationship. He's not the boss that goes off and sits in his office and locks the door and never talks to anyone. He comes out and eats with them. He wasn't expected to do that, but he shares with them and he eats with them. And he inquires about Ruth. Who does this young woman belong to? He takes an interest in her, and he provides extravagantly for her. He protects her. He says, "Protect, stay in my field so you don't go to someone else's field who might hurt you." He instructs his own workers, don't touch her, don't lay a hand on her. You're going to protect her. He invites her to eat with them, and he gives her food from his own hand, and even says, dip your bread in my sauce so you don't have to eat dry bread. This isn't something that would have been expected from Boaz, but he does it anyways. He says, you can drink water from our jars. This is completely backwards, by the way. In that day, if you were a woman or a foreigner and an Israelite man came to the well, the widow or the foreigner would be expected to draw water for the Israelite man. And here is Ruth, a foreigner and a woman, and Boaz is saying, no, the men will do the work and you can just benefit from it. You can drink whatever you'd like from here. And then he gives special provision from the harvest as well. He goes above and beyond what was expected of him. Now, gleaning laws in the Old Testament were God's way of actually providing for the poor. So there was an expectation in the law that when you were harvesting your field, you would leave some behind so that poor people could come behind and pick up after you. So in Deuteronomy 24, verse 19, when you're harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, don't go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, don't go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, don't go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That's why I command you to do this. You remember what it was like to have nothing and to be oppressed. So I command you to remember those who have nothing and who are oppressed. The foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. This was in the law. Now, other places in the law, it talks about don't glean all the way to the edge of your field, but leave what's kind of on the edge. But you know that what's on the edge of a field is usually not the most impressive, right? The good stuff is further into the middle. Well, Boaz says to his workers, okay, let Ruth pick up after you, but also just kind of drop some of what you've already harvested. Just kind of say, oops, I dropped that, clumsy me. And then she can pick it up after you. So he actually goes above and beyond what the law required of him to provide for Ruth. And Ruth walks out that day with 30 to 50 pounds of barley. Some scholars think that's kind of unbelievable. Actually, the picture is that Ruth can barely carry all that she's got back to her house. So he takes her under his wings. Now, it's interesting in verse 12, Boaz, when he first talks to Ruth, he says, may Yahweh reward you for your actions. May your compensation be full from Yahweh, the God of Israel, to whom you have come to seek refuge under his wings. So the prayer that Boaz, you know, kind of prays right in front of Ruth as he talks to her is, would you find comfort as you seek refuge under God's wings? And then what does Boaz do? It's almost like he stretches out his proverbial wings and says, I'm going to be the answer to my own prayer here. I'm going to be the way that God gives you refuge, the way that God gives you comfort, the way that God provides for you is going to come through me. I'm going to be the one through whom this prayer is answered, because this is often how God works. His provision to us comes through other people. Now, the way the book of Ruth is written, verses 18 to 23 of chapter 2 are the very center of the book. There are 40 verses before and there are 40 verses after, which makes verse 20 the very center of the book. And some scholars, as they look at it, see that that's really significant. This is the point that we're supposed to see in the very middle. So what does verse 20 say? Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by Yahweh because he has not abandoned his loving kindness toward the living and the dead. Now there's some ambiguity here in the Hebrew about who he is. In this verse, is this verse saying, may Yahweh be blessed? May God himself be blessed because he has not abandoned his loving kindness toward the living and the dead? Or is Naomi talking about Boaz? May Boaz be blessed by Yahweh because he has not abandoned his loving kindness to the living and the dead? And scholars disagree about, is this Boaz or is it God? Is it God that's blessed because he's faithful, or is it Boaz that is blessed because he's demonstrating God's faithfulness? And I think the ambiguity here might be on purpose to say both, right? God is blessed because he's so faithful, but often God's blessing comes through another person who demonstrates faithfulness. And this is one of the key things that we're supposed to remember throughout this book, is that God's blessing comes to us and often through other people. You've probably experienced this at various points in your life. I can remember my journey through seminary. I sat down with my wife at the beginning and said, okay, this is what it's all going to cost. Made a spreadsheet of all the costs and thought, this is going to be really expensive, but I think I can do it. But the actual cost of going through seminary was way lower than I thought it was, because people over and over and over again generously gave either to myself or to the school. There were scholarships that came into play. Our church was generous towards that. And it was just a way that God provided through other people. This was God's provision to me. And it wasn't by zapping thousands of dollars into my bank account. It was through other people's generosity that God provided. So who's been this person for you? How have you experienced God's gracious provision through somebody else? And then how have you been this person for someone else? Because that's the flip side of this reality, is that God uses you as his provision to somebody else. Maybe somebody who's in need or who needs encouragement. How is God using you? What is a need that you could fulfill as a demonstration of God's chesed towards us? So God's provision, gracious provision, comes to us through circumstances, through other people. Thirdly, it comes to us through our own effort. Now, we should notice here that Ruth works hard in order to effect change. She sees there's a need. I need food. My mother-in-law needs food. I'm going to do something about that. And so she goes and she does the hard work. She puts in the sweat and tears in order to actually bring food back. So there's some indication here that Daniel Block sees in the text that her entrance into the field is actually notable because she's a little bit more forward or impatient than most. The foreman reports back to Boaz that this woman came to me and said, I'd like to glean and gather among the sheaves. Well, gleaning you can understand because she's a widow, she's a foreigner, she's poor, she has this right under the Israelite law to glean. But gathering is something beyond that. And so Block says this supervisor actually sounds a little bit annoyed with Ruth because she's so forward. She's inserting herself into the situation, maybe even more than what is warranted. But Ruth is working hard. She sees there's a need and she says, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do what I can in order to do it. Now, if we were to read Genesis 1, 2, and 3, we would see that work is something that existed before the fall. That Adam and Eve would have gone and worked the ground, and it would have produced a crop for them. And that was a part of the human vocation right from the beginning. But part of the curse is that work is now extremely difficult. God says to Adam that the ground is going to produce thorns and thistles, and by blood, sweat, and tears, you're going to do this work now. And so work in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's actually something that's part of the human vocation, who we are as people. And Ruth takes delight in this work. She goes out and gives herself wholeheartedly to it. Now, there's something else that's interesting here. I told you that in the Protestant Bible, Ruth comes between Judges and 1 Samuel, and I told you why. In the Hebrew arrangement of the Old Testament, Ruth actually comes after the book of Proverbs. Now, why would the arrangement be that way? Why would Ruth come right after Proverbs? Well, Proverbs 31 ends with a description of a woman, specifically a wife of noble character. And how she's described, verse 10, a wife of noble character who can find, she's worth far more than rubies. And then verse 17, she sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. And it actually describes her work ethic all the way through this chapter of this is what a wife of noble character is like. She delights in the work of her hands and in providing for her family and supporting her husband and working within this family structure. And then in the Hebrew Bible comes Ruth as an example of what this looks like in action. So Ruth is praised for her hard work. And this is part of the way in which God's provision comes about. If Ruth hadn't gone out into the field, would this provision have still happened? Well, maybe, but not in the same way. So it leads us to ask the question, okay, what is the relationship between faith and works then? Did Ruth go out and effect this change all on her own? Well, I think we have to say this is a part of the story. It's not the whole part of the story, but it's a part of the story. And James describes this relationship in James chapter 2, verse 14. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I'll show you my faith by my deeds. This is what Boaz does, right, in the story. He doesn't say to Ruth, oh, I see that you're hungry. I'm really sorry about that. I hope that works out for you. No, he says, I'm going to provide for you. And Ruth says, and keep in mind, we don't really know Ruth's relationship with Yahweh very well yet. And she might not have really known it either. She said to Naomi, your God will now be my God. So there's that element of faith. And she's submitting herself to the Israelite law and going out to glean like she's allowed to. We don't really know what her level of faith and trust is. But she certainly demonstrates a degree of trust in how hard she works in order to bring about this change. So we don't want to become workaholics and say, I have to work to achieve God's favor and God's gracious provision. But what Ruth shows us is that God honors the deeds that we do because of our faith. We don't act in order to achieve our salvation. We act because our salvation is so meaningful to us, and God's chesed has been internalized by us that we respond with generosity in our deeds. So this is one way in which God's gracious provision comes about. Ruth put her hand to the plow, so to speak. So God's gracious provision comes to us through our circumstances, through other people, through our own effort. It also comes through His law. Now, we might read the Old Testament law and think, wow, that's really, really strict. And why are there so many rules? And why did God arrange things this way? And, well, those poor people that had to figure all of this out. Well, that's not the attitude that the Israelites had about the law, at least not at their best. Right? They saw the law as God's gracious provision to them. In fact, Daniel Block points out, the greater detail that a God gives to His people, the greater the grace, because you don't have to guess at what's required. You know, Daniel Block, in a conference I was at with him several months ago, pointed out in ancient writing there is what has been found, a prayer to an unknown God. And in this prayer, the person is just pleading with this unknown God to provide for them and to show them what's required. Forgive my sins that I've committed. Forgive the sins I know nothing about because I don't know what you require. And help me to know what I'm supposed to do because you haven't told me. And it's just this desperate plea to this unknown God that, would you please show me what I'm supposed to do? Well, God's law provides that for the people. So it's described really positively. And in Psalm 19, we have an example in verse 7 to 11. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They're more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them there is great reward. They saw the law as God's gracious provision to them. Now, where we live on this side of the cross, Jesus came to fulfill the law, and so many of these things are not required of us anymore, and yet Jesus came and presented us with the way to live, right? You know, blessed are the peacemakers. Forgive as I have forgiven you. Be kind and compassionate to one another. Turn the other cheek. All of the ways of the kingdom that Jesus presents are a gift to us. And sometimes we can have the attitude like, oh, these commands are so burdensome. Why is Jesus commanding all of this about purity or about treating other people well? It would be so much easier if I could just do what I want. And yet the law of the Lord, the law of Christ, if you will, is a generous gift to us. And in it, as we give ourselves to it, we find freedom in it. Because God has told us what He wants for us. And it's that we act in these ways. So His law is a way that He provides. So we've seen this already in the gleaning laws. Right? This is a way in which God's provision came to Ruth in this story is the gleaning laws. We also are introduced to a concept at the end of this chapter where Boaz is named a kinsman redeemer for Ruth and Naomi. Now, this law is spelled out in various places in the Old Testament, and it's a way in which families are preserved. So family units and family inheritance and family relationships and dynamics are really, really important. We don't really even think about our families in the same way today. We value our families, but not in the same way that they did in that culture. And so land would be passed down through the generations, for instance. And so sometimes there is an instance where a family member was in trouble and another family could come in and save the day. So there's five circumstances in which this could happen. Number one, buying back hereditary property that had passed into the hands of a person outside the clan. So if I owned a piece of land and I was poor and I had to sell it and I sold it to someone outside my family, an extended family member of mine could come in and buy that field to keep it back into the family. Number two, purchasing the freedom of individuals within the clan that had sold themselves into slavery because of poverty. So if I'm really poor, I sell myself to you as a slave so that I can make money to pay my debts. Well, an extended family member can come in and buy me back out of slavery. Number three, this is a tough one for us, tracking down and executing murderers of near relatives. This is spelled out in Numbers. Someone murders a family member, I can go and track that person down, and it's kind of an eye for an eye kind of situation. Number four, receiving restitution money on behalf of a deceased victim of a crime. So if you kill my family member, I can come in and say you owe this amount of restitution. You know, the judge has said that you owe this much money. You can pay it to me because I'm a family member. Number five, ensuring justice was served in a lawsuit involving a relative. So I come in and I make sure that justice actually happens. Now, we'll get into this in future chapters, so we won't really explain it much now. But scholars look at these five conditions and say none of them really apply to Boaz and Naomi here. None of them explicitly apply. And so what we're supposed to see here is that Boaz, as a noble man of character, is actually seeing the spirit of this law, and not just following the letter of the law, he's going beyond the letter of the law to provide for a relative. And we'll see how that happens in the next few chapters. But what we see here is God's law is put in place as his gracious provision to us. So we see God's gracious provision through circumstances, through other people, through our own effort, through his law, and then finally, through his provision in the big picture. Now, what do I mean by that? When we look at the big picture here, this story really isn't about Ruth or Naomi or Boaz. This story is about something much bigger than that. It's about God's provision for his people. And so his provision is going to come eventually through the arrival of a king through this family line. This king, first of all, this King David, and ultimately King Jesus is going to come through this line, through the child that is born to Ruth from Boaz. This is ultimately what God is doing in this story, is his provision for his people, the fulfillment of his promises that he would bless the world through this nation, Israel. That's really what's going on here. We see it happening, though, in this ordinary kind of circumstance, this ordinary life of Ruth and Naomi and Boaz pursuing faithfulness in ordinary ways, and God's extraordinary faithfulness comes through to the world through their story. And it makes me wonder how much of my story and how much of your story is not really about you at all and not really about me at all. You know, what is it that God is going to use my life for that's way bigger than me? You know, maybe my role is actually to train my children who will train their children, who will train their children, who will train their children. And 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 generations down the road, God wants to do something really amazing. You know, certainly God wants to use my story and your story, but it fits into a bigger picture. And we might not even see the bigger picture. It might not be anything close to us. But when we do get glimpses of how our story fits into the big picture, it's a real gift. So I think of 10 years ago now, in March of 2023, I broke my back playing hockey and separated my shoulder. And my parents and my mother-in-law and father-in-law were there when it happened, and they came with me to the hospital. It was a Saturday night, it was about 11. And they were all there with me, and then who else showed up but Art Birch, Pastor Art. I was the youth pastor at the time, he was my boss, lead pastor of our church. And he showed up, drove from Abbotsford to Langley to visit with me and to pray with me. It was like 11:30 at night. And that left such an impression on my father-in-law that he would come all that way in the middle of the night when he had to preach in the morning to come and pray and show care and concern. And for about 5 years after that, my father-in-law lived for another 5 years after that, repeatedly he would say about how good of a guy that Art is. What a good man. Remember how he came out to the hospital and was there for you when you hurt yourself? What an amazing man. Well, 5 years later or 4 years later, my father-in-law came down with cancer, and it looked as if the end of his life was drawing near, and it was. And in that moment, Art reached out to him and said, "Hey, can I come by every couple of weeks to pray with you and see how you're doing?" Well, my father-in-law had a bit of a skeptical relationship with pastors and with the church. But because of that moment 4 or 5 years earlier, where Art had showed up at the hospital, he had such a positive impression of Art that he said, "Yes, you can." And through those conversations, weeks before he died, he prayed to accept the Lord because of that repeated contact. Well, when I broke my back, I was full of questions, right? Why is this happening? God, what are you doing here? I don't like this. Well, 5 years later, I get the glimpse of the story that says, oh, maybe that really wasn't about me at all. Maybe God was just using me as a part of his story to call someone to himself that he desperately loved and wanted to be part of his family. And when I see that perspective, I say, God, if you want to do that again, I'll do that 100 times over. Because I see what you're doing. And you're using this, you're using me and even my pain to do something that I couldn't see. Now, that's a gift that I can look back on that story and say God was using it for good. Sometimes we don't get that glimpse. And maybe we'll never see it until eternity, how God is using our story as a part of something bigger than us. But he is. This is how his gracious provision comes to us and to the world, is by how he works in our stories in ways that we can't quite see. So Waldo is on every page. Sometimes he's easy to see, sometimes he's not. But the question I leave you with today is, are you looking for him? Are you looking for how God is at work in your story and how his grace is coming to you in many different ways? He's there if you'll see him, if you'll listen for him, if you'll look for him. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, I thank you for this story of Ruth that reminds us of so much and reminds us of the ways in which you are active and present in our stories. And God, those of us who are listening to this, we come to you in a variety of ways and from a variety of places. Some of us can really feel your presence really strongly right now, and others of us have been longing for your presence for a long time and just feel like we can't find it. So, Lord, may you open our eyes to the ways in which you are working in our lives. May we see the ways in which you are orchestrating things, the way that you are bringing people into our lives, the way that our work is producing something good, the way that your law gives us a glimpse of who you are and how you're using us in a much larger way than we can recognize. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.